Live Line on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry, bringing you great savings on curtains and bedding. Available all year in store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Live Line. The list goes on, but the accommodation that's necessary on the national broadcaster is really important for people, many of them telling their stories for the first time about physical abuse. And it's a coincidence as far as I'm concerned. It's a perfect storm in terms of, one, people talking about the scoping inquiry, the O'Toole inquiry, which is only dealing, obviously, that's it was remit with sexual abuse. That prompted a number of people last Wednesday and Thursday here on Liveline to talk about physical abuse. And as I mentioned a number of times, the sluice gates of Ardna Croche have opened in terms of people revealing what went on and the way they were physically treated in the care of the state by adults when they were babies and children. John, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
You use the phrase a rabbit kick. What's a rabbit kick?
A rabbit punch, Joe.
Oh, punch, okay.
To the back of my neck, yeah.
And what is it with the fist, obviously?
With a fist, yeah.
Okay.
With a fist.
And who was the perpetrator?
I'm from the west of Ireland originally, and I went to school there, national school. And loved school, Joe.
Yeah.
Loved learning, loved everything about school. I was always early. I was always first in class.
Great.
And I was one morning, lovely, I remember the morning well. I was first in class, went in to the class, and from behind the door, this brother jumped out on top of me. From behind, had me in a stranglehold, and his hand around my neck,
yeah,
and rubbing his face up against mine, and thrusting himself at the back, and fondling my privates. And I managed... First of all, I tried to figure out what was going on, tried to register what was happening, and I managed to break away and run out into the yard and wait for the other pupils to arrive. And I went in with the other pupils into the class, and that morning, a couple of hours after that, still in shock. And he had us around the desk in a kind of a semicircle reading our Irish books. And I remember reading my book, and I could see him. He left his desk, walked to the left, and went around behind me. And I received this unmerciful blow. I woke up on the floor with blood streaming from my nose and blood all over my Irish book. And I just couldn't figure out why it happened, what I did. You know, couldn't register with me. I couldn't speak to anybody about it. I didn't tell my parents or anything like that.
We've heard
that
some.
Day.
Keep going.
Yeah, listening. I haven't spoken about it to a lot of people, but listening to the good people that have been talking to you, Joe, recently, I got the courage, and I wanted to stand with them, the survivors of this abuse. And some of the men there said, I loved school. That day, I stopped learning. I couldn't open a book, couldn't do anything, you know, academic after that. That day, I finished learning.
Fear took over, I presume. Fear.
Fear. Fear took over. And then went to secondary school from there. Every day was just, you know, the fear and the pit of your stomach going into school, wondering who was going to attack you next, what was going to happen next. And, you know, in secondary school then, the guy with the big leather strap, Franciscan brother, he was well able to swing that. And, you know, every day. What mood was he going to come in? If he didn't have cigarettes, he'd take the matchbox out. You know, remember the matchbox with the red matches?
Of course I do, yeah.
And he'd be frothing at the mouth and licking the sulfur on the matchbox with rage. And one day, he forgot the strap. And it went frayed at the end because he was using it so much. It was frayed. There was a couple of layers of leather in it, stitched. And we got the strap and we ripped it apart. We hid it on the floorboards.
Well done.
He came back looking for it.
Yeah.
And with rage, he left the classroom. We all wondered where he was. We all went to the window. Down at the end of the avenue, the P&T, the aircom now, it was the old Post and Telegraph's truck. He went to the back of the truck and he had his hands apart. In other words, I want that length. Hmm. And they cut him a piece off what they call anti-gram cable. It's a underground. It's cable that you would put underground. It's on the outside, it's a sheet, and then inside, there's reinforced with wire. And then you have the cable running through that. He came back to the classroom. He put that down, his habit, carried it back, and came into the classroom. And the guy that was sitting beside me, he asked him a question. He came in with this mad rage. And he asked him a question, the guy that was beside me. And Peter, I call him, stood up, lovely guy, very nice fella. He stood up to answer the question. He didn't even give him a chance. He pulled this cable out, hit him on the top of the head. The cable slid down, broke his glasses, and cut his ear. And at that stage, okay. I had enough.
Okay.
I was about 14 then.
Yeah.
And I jumped on him. Yeah. And I bet him out of the classroom with that cable. And we didn't see him for days after that. That was midweek. Then by the Saturday, I used to do a bit of work for my father on the Saturday, and I came into the house. Mm-hmm. This brother was there having tea with my mother and father.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying that I needed to be in a mental institution, or nobody could teach me. And he wanted to be admitted into an institution. And when I seen him at the table, Joe, I lost the plot again and kicked him out the door. That was my story.
And how did your parents react?
My mother, remember, she was blessing herself when I lost the plot in the house. And when I told her, I didn't tell her about the incident in the National School.
Mm-hmm.
But when I told her what happened and what he was like, and she kind of, well, my father just, you know, agreed with what I did.
Okay.
You know.
And did you go back to that school, John?
I left after that, Joe. I couldn't learn. You know, I remember sitting going through the motions with the intercert.
Mm.
And I just turned up. Went in the class like everybody else, and I scribbled on the page, Joe. It felt terrible. You know, I why I was doing it, you know. I felt I was a freak. You know, I felt it was just me. Why was I feeling like this? You know? And it was terrible growing up like that, feeling like that. And then after the results were posted, hung up in the front, foyer at the school, you know, my name, Big Zero, you know. And
that
was hard to take, Joe.
That image, of course it was.
Yeah.
And John, that image of reading your Irish book, him prowling and circling around, coming up.
That's right.
Your next memories, you wake up,
on the floor, blood over the place and on my Irish book. And a couple of years ago, Joe,
mm-hmm.
I was having trouble with my neck and shoulder.
Okay.
And I had an x-ray on it, and there's a piece you know, the tail of the vertebrae up there between your... Yes, it's floating there. It's broken off. And I was wondering how that happened. So that's how that happened.
Well, that's, look, rabbit punches are pretty...
Absolutely.
Be a,
come down full force with
can
fist.
Can be a pretty consequential punch in terms of severe and irreversible injury.
Yeah. I was totally unconscious. I don't know how long I was out for, Joe. Couldn't tell you.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
But I recently spoke to another student that was there, and we know he was abused by the same. He has difficulty talking about it. We're only starting to talk about it.
Yes, he does.
And he fondled him in front of us in the classroom.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, John. I can move on to Jackie. Jackie, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe.
You've been listening to the stories.
I have indeed, and I liked the word that John used there. Sorry, I'm very emotional.
Take your time.
Used the word survivor instead of the word victim, and I like that.
Yeah.
I thought even what's coming up to me, you know, is that feeling of fear again, fear of speaking out. You know, and yesterday I was listening intently, and I think it was the first time ever I've heard the words that I needed to hear.
Yeah. And the words, were they stuck inside you, trapped inside you?
The words that you believe that were rubbish. You know, I grew up in that primary school, believing that I was stupid, believing I was tick-over with another word somebody used yesterday. You know, you just lose all sense of belief in yourself to the point where you feel rubbish, you know. And I grew up in that fear, 9, 10, 11 years of age, going to school. I hated going to school. I had a sense of dread going to school. You know, the headmaster was a man... his such anger in him and vengeance, that's all I can remember seeing on his face when he'd have a stick, he'd get one of the kids from the class to go out. I can't remember myself going out to get the stick from the branch of the tree.
Yeah.
That psychological fear and bringing it in, and just you missed a spelling, you missed a word, you forgot to memorize that catechism. My God, the catechism. You know, and the stick would whack down on your hands. I can still feel the numbness in my fingers at 9 years of age. And I think the worst part was being brought up in the class, a room full of silence. And you go up there and you know what's coming. You know what's coming. And just, I think, you know, you bring such hurt and shame with me through life. And, you know, that teacher at 9 years of age knocked the joy of learning out of me, like that John just said. You know, I hated secondary school and the teachers in secondary school. I didn't experience anything in secondary school, only the fact that I felt so stupid. I was in the D class, you know, the dunce with the D hat, you know, and the impact of, I think, those final 3 years in primary school really impacted the way I lived my life into my adult world. Jesus. Always.
How long have these words been, your words, trapped inside you?
I think a trauma came into my life I'm 61 this year. And in my early 40s, a massive trauma came knocking on my door.
Yeah.
And it was out of that that I realised that the only way I could get through the level of pain that came with it was to shut down completely.
Yeah.
And I think I learned that from my childhood, how to shut down in the face of such fear and terror and pain, and you know, the depth of that was just too hard for me to take in. And then I went on and I did counselling, and just through counselling then, so about Only 10 years ago, Joe. Only 10 years ago, I started to acknowledge, I suppose, that even though I was only hit as a child, it had a massive impact on the emotional well-being of me growing up, of that, you know, because I always diminished it. I wasn't sexually abused. I wasn't, you know, beaten to the pulp like some of those stories over the week, my God, but the emotional impact of that really affected me growing up, as I think it has done to the nation, to this generation in our country.
And as I say, anyone under their mid-40s would not have, hopefully, should not have experienced corporal punishment, but it's truly shocking.
No.
The number of
it's
people
over
40, 50, 60, 70s, 80s who are now talking for the first time about the
just talking about it is now giving us time to grieve, because that's what we need to do.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing. And you've created that platform for us.
And it wasn't your fault under any circumstances.
That's it. I did nothing wrong.
Of course you did nothing wrong.
No. But you grew up believing you did. Well, am I wrong? I've done something wrong. It's the message you get. It's the message you get that I'm stupid, that I'm not worthy of being here, you know? Not worthy of learning. I'm never going to learn.
But you have spoken about it. You have.
I have.
Yeah. Yeah. That does help. That does help.
And John, I just wanted to be a part of that cohort of people who are now coming together and sharing that,
And when this personal tragedy befell you and your family, that's what sparked the reflection back on what happened to you as a child.
It did, because I went into a 7-year depression following this trauma. I don't want to bring it up now. I went into a 7-year depression, and that was going into my 50s, and I just realised one day, I can't keep going on like this. I'm tired of feeling sadness, and the depth of this sadness is more than what this is. There's something else going on. Yeah. And then I started looking into and reflecting back and doing the work on myself. Yeah. I studied my story.
Brilliant.
It took 10 years.
Well done. Well, onwards, Jackie.
Onwards and inwards.
And
thank you.
You know, from your professional career now and your professional training, you know what you're saying. No one has answers, but you know by telling your story like this, you're not just helping other people in their own inwards, as you say, but outwards as well, because it's allowing people and encouraging people to speak about it for the first time and realising that they were not alone, that babies and children, they do no wrong. They cannot do wrong that would warrant physical attack by an adult.
Yeah.
They make little mistakes. You heard Jackie. You heard the caller 2 days ago, 4 years and 2 months. 50 months old.
That's right.
Beaten until he soiled himself.
Yeah.
Didn't speak for, and he was a great talker before, didn't speak for 3 months. And then when he did speak, had an unstoppable stammer, especially when he was in school. Now he's dealt with it now. But a baby, as you were.
Yeah.
Jackie, thanks.
I'd just like to say that we talk about and we hear a lot about lately the word trauma.
Yeah.
And it's not enough, because the bigger trauma is what we didn't get as children growing up. It's what our country didn't receive, you know, that pure, unconditional love that we so deserved and that we didn't get, you know. We couldn't get. There's too much generational trauma in this country.
Yeah. Well, it's a cause and a subject for even deeper reflection and examination.
Absolutely.
Jackie, thank you so much. Thank you, Jackie. 51551 is our text number. Beatrice, before the break, and remember, you go onto the RT website, there are various helplines available. Beatrice, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. Good afternoon, Joe.
You were good academically.
Yes, good academically.
But you were weak, or useless, if you use your own word, at religious doctrine.
I just seem to have a blank about Christian doctrine.
So what?
We have this book called Hart's Doctrine in grade 3.
Okay.
And I don't know what it was when I look back and think about it. I think it was a combination of canon law and passages from the Gospel. But for some reason, I wasn't either interested in it or I just couldn't retain what I learned.
Yeah.
And every morning, the following morning, I would be called upon by this particular nun and stand up, and she'd ask me a question on it. And I just couldn't answer her. So the penance was penance for tea.
Okay. Penance for tea. This was obviously in your boarding school where you were there for 5 years.
Yes, school. I was there for 5 years in the 60s.
What does penance for tea mean?
Okay, well, normally for tea you'd get something like maybe jam or some crisps or a bar of chocolate or some sausages or a fried egg. Mm-hmm. But if you were in penance for tea, you got nothing except bread and tea. So for many, many weeks in succession, I was in penance for tea because I couldn't remember my Christian doctrine. And I just remember those nights just going to bed starving. Wow. Because it's very hard to eat stone ground bread if you don't have jam or something on it.
Yeah, yeah.
It just doesn't go down. You're chewing this thing like a hamster. And, you know, it remains in your mouth. And I just remember nights when I was so hungry. And then you were playing hockey and you were playing netball and you were in an orchestra and you were doing all these things that required a lot of energy, but you weren't, your energy wasn't being replaced by proper food. And I was saying to your researcher, I have torn up all those photographs of me at school because I am so thin, you know, you could just see the bones coming out through my uniform because I just wasn't eating.
So food deprivation was used as a form
food
of punishment.
Yes.
And I don't think any boarding school has ever won an award for the quality of its food or the quantity
of food was awful. Yes, exactly. But to have denied somebody that because they couldn't remember a passage of a very sort of dry religious book seemed to me.
And did you hide food? Did you try and secrete food? Did you try and gather food from?
Yeah. Yes. The heels of brown bread, I used to put it between my Latin book and try and bring it up to the dormitory and hope nobody would see you, you know, would see me eating this, you know, anything to sort of supplement the bread, the sort of food that I had been denied.
Food awful, penance. Did your family notice that you were losing weight, Beatrice?
Well, I was always thin, you know, burning it up, you know. But my mother used to come and visit us and she'd try and bring us stews and things like that to fatten me up. But in those days, you know, you were just considered growing up and you were playing all this hockey and that and maybe, you know, I wasn't sort of losing weight as such. I just was terribly thin.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just remember being hungry a lot of the time at school.
And then there was the episode you tell us in your contact about when your mother passed and you were so young.
Yes, I had just turned 15 and I went back to school a week after her funeral and I was crying in the dormitory one night and this same nun who used to put me in penance for tea, she had a bee in her bonnet about myself and my sister, I think. She came up into my cubicle and she shook me in the bed and she said, "Stop sniveling," she said. You're keeping the other girls awake.
Oh, my God. And your mother had died. Mm.
Yes, yeah, my mother had died, yeah.
Okay. Beatrice, thank you for that. 5 years in that boarding school.
Thank you for
sharing that. And I'll say it again. If you go onto the RT website, there's many, many helplines available. I know a lot of people are getting a lot of help from hearing and talking and listening to each other. So thank you indeed, Beatrice and Jackie and John and more after this break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
The principal, who was a Christian brother, had an array of leathers known as biffers. The one to be feared was the white biffer because it was paler in colour. He had coins stitched into it. I remember young boys as young as six sobbing and using the cold metal legs of the school desks to cool their hands. I remember seeing one lad wetting himself with fear and spending the whole day in wet trousers.
It was a good school, which meant if you got things wrong, you were battered. If you were poor or had any life about you, you were punished. If we weren't hit, we had to observe others being thrashed. The boys were treated more harshly than us girls. One boy had a seizure in front of us. Children with stammers were mocked and beaten. Children ran home and were dragged back by their parents. Children from the travelling community were put at the back and we weren't allowed to speak to them. One time I was ridiculed in front of the whole school for vomiting outside due to a bug. We had to cut our sticks from the hedge. If we got a catechism answer wrong in front of the priest, we were thrashed afterwards. They encouraged us to tell on each other. The main lesson they taught us was to lie and cheat. The psychological impact was extreme anxiety and lack of trust in others. I became emotionally numb and cynical about adults and also had no respect for authority in secondary school. I survived. I've had a good life working with children. They didn't win.
I'm 70 now. My memories have flooded back of a little boy, the 8-year-old me, taking beatings for what? A terrible childhood at the hands of the Christian Brothers bullies. I've never spoken about it since and probably never will. I remember when I couldn't do a sum being beaten, and when break came, the brother told class not to tell me the answer or they would get the same as me. When I went home, my mother told me it was my own fault.
And again, just we've been in one sense forced to do it this way because we've had so much contact from so many people, is to take excerpts from the emails, from the letters, from the phone calls and deliver them to each other in that particular way. David, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe.
David, you were reared in a village in West Limerick and you say from the age of 6 to 12. 6 years of age to 12 years of age, what was your experience?
Yeah, if I could just mention the background. First of all, Joe, I want to say I'm in emotional wreck since this all started a few days ago, you know.
Okay.
And if I become emotional, it's because I'm not sleeping and I haven't slept for 3 nights. And one day I couldn't, I've listened to your show for years, but I couldn't listen to it. One day I was very low in my forum, and that's how it is.
Okay.
But, you know, I realised in the last few years, I realised I had deep-rooted problems about all my schooling, you know.
Mm.
And how I came to realise it is that we heard all about the sexual abuse by the clergy and, you know, about new reports about it and all this stuff, and which, of course, was horrific and all that. But I felt very trapped with my own story. I felt, there's nobody listening to me. There's nobody listening to the other people that were abused by the labelled school teachers. And that's just, I was angry. I got awful anger every time I heard about it. And I knew I had issues, you know.
Yeah.
But what happened to me, from the age that you mentioned, first of all, like schoolhouse, it should have been called Fear House, you know. That's exactly what it was, a fear house, you know. I went into the master's room and he just seemed to get a set on 3 or 4 of us, more so than on the rest of the class, you know.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I was one of those. I would have been a timid child by nature, you know, and I think I was vulnerable to his needs, you know. And it has been said about the stick and the cutting down of the stick. And he'd send you back to the field to cut down the blackthorn stick. And you knew that you were going to be the first victim of the beating. You knew you were cutting down your own punishment. He seemed to get a kick out of punishing you first, as if she was punishing you for cutting the stick. So you knew what was facing you when you went back into that school, you know. That was one of the things. Like a lot of what I have to say has been said, but there was one, you know, I found the physical stuff easier than the mental torture, you know.
Okay.
And one of the main methods of humiliation on me. Joe, I have no issue with in life that we all suffer, you know, for different episodes once off, and, you know, it's life and we have to cope with it, and that's fine. But my issues are with the compounded nature of the beatings on a daily, on a weekly, on a monthly basis, you know. I lived with fear. I used to go home, I lived in the village, and I'd go home for lunch, and on my way back with my older brother every day, and I mean every day, it's a mantra, but what I used to say to my older brother was, will he be hurt this evening? Will he be hurt this evening? Yeah. And I, in such fear of going back into that classroom, will he be hurt this evening? It's etched in my brain, those words are. And the most humiliating part of what went on was, part of his punishment was, he, and this was on a regular basis, as I say, if it was a once a year, but this was regular all the time for those years. He'd put out his chair in front of the classroom. He'd, his words, these are, I'll stall you up. Now, stalling you up was, he put my head between his legs, between his thighs. He tightened the grip on my head with his legs. He'd lift me up in the air with my legs upwards. And he'd put his hands under my shirt and tickle me under the arms, with the result that my legs were wriggling in the air. And that is the hardest part. That was hard. Yeah. That humiliation was harder than any beatings I got from that man, you know. And that was how it was, the humiliation, legs up in the air and my legs, you know.
Your, but your leg, your head, your small head,
my
locked,
small head.
Locked between the knees and upper thighs of an adult. Of a grown man.
My neck and head would have been on his crotch, basically.
And using his legs to hoist your head into the air, lifting you off the ground.
No, to hoist my legs. My head was between his thigh, touching his crotch. The back of my head would have been touching his crotch. So he lifted me up then, and my legs were in the air.
Yeah.
And then he put his hands under my T-shirt and my shirt.
And abused
under my, and no, he didn't abuse me. He tickled me under the arms. And, you know, I actually tried tickling myself last night to see about this, and there was no tickles. But as a child, your skin would be so sensitive. So my legs are wriggling with the tickling sensation, you know. And that is the most painful part, was that humiliation, you know. And, you know, and the awful thing was, I could say nothing. He was a friend of my father's, and you just accepted it, you just took it, and you could just do nothing about it, you know.
And I'm very conscious, David, of you saying the last 3 days and three nights, because of what you've been hearing from others, have had such a deep effect on you.
Well, I've always known that it affected my life, it affected my confidence, you know. It's you know, I got a job. It affected me in secondary school, in that obviously, I sent signals that I was a weak person, that I didn't feel good, I didn't feel that, and I was picked on for 6-5 years of whatever length of time by a school bully, and I was sneered and hissed at, and I'm talking about every day for the 5 years, you know. So you can imagine the state of me going into the workforce, you know, and the confidence levels being so low. But I learned to adopt and put on the brave face and all that, you know. But the confidence, and I had depression then, and I was drinking, and I had to give up alcohol, you know. And I have no doubt that what he did to me made the quality of my life much worse than it has been, you know. And in saying that, I also believe that I've had a lovely life. I've wonderful children, supportive friends, and that, but it has had awful, you know. One of the things, I'm sensitive, I'm another thing is I can't accept rejection. I find it very, very, very difficult to accept rejection if I'm rejected by family or friends. And I put that down to the fact that all those years were years of rejection. And, you know, so that's basically my story, Joe. And if I could just describe it, I was thinking of a description for it all, you know. And How did it was written here, just what I came up with this morning.
Time, yeah.
And it, what I've written is just that I describe it as like, it's like having an extra organ in my body that's dormant, but it's full of pain. And no doctor can remove it. And you're stuck with it. It's inoperable. That's how it is. That's how the feelings come up, you know. And you, I even fooled myself for years that I had had, I told myself, and my mind told myself, that I had had counselling on it, you know. But it was a trick of my mind. I never had counselling, but I believed I had. And I think I put that belief into my head so that I wouldn't have to face the thought of it. But I didn't have counselling, you know, never did, you know. Yeah. And, yeah, that's more or less my story.
But you have, too. You have insight.
Oh, I have huge insight. Yes, I have huge insight.
And I'm also thinking, as you're talking, for some reason, David, I'm thinking of the people. They were lone voices in the Irish body politic and Irish life in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Yeah. I'm thinking, by the way, I was looking up more stuff last night about who raised, who tried to shout stop. They were hounded down. But I saw on one vote, the late Dr. Gareth Fitzgerald, he tried to shout stop. Our current Uachtaráin na hÉireann, Michael D. Higgins, when he was in the Shannon and the Dáil, he tried to shout stop. These are formidable individuals. Obviously, I'm thinking about Frank Crummy and Cyril Daly and Dick Clear, all those people in civic society that tried. But they were shouted down. They were shouted down. Right. By the way, the last 3 days, I hope Dave would remind you and the effect it's had on you that you were a deeply, deeply human person. And your reaction, your reaction is deeply human and humane. And it's a great pity that did not prevail in the, these were places of authority, places of the so-called safety of the state, paid for by the state, set up by the state, legalised by the state. And it's a pity that level of humanity did not exist in so many other adults, when they were treating children like you in such a horrific, long-lasting way.
Yes. And Joe, if I may find a state that, you know, putting his hands under my toes and my head between his thighs, etc. I was a child. I didn't even know what sex was. I just didn't.
Of course, of course.
In discussing this with a school friend, he had no doubt, his deceased since, he had no doubt that in relation to the headmaster, there was a sexual connotation in the whole exercise. Yeah. You know, I didn't sense that at the time, you know, but he sensed, he felt it was a sexual connotation, you know.
David, thanks indeed for sharing that. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Joe@rte.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
We had a priest who would examine us on the catechism every Friday in the headmaster's absence. He would come in at 12 noon and allow the headmaster off early for his lunch. Normal break time was from 12:30 to 1 p.m. He would then proceed to question us on the catechism, and if you missed a question, he would take out a gun barrel cleaner, which was concealed up his sleeve, presumably so the headmaster would not see it. Most of us would miss the question through fear and nervousness, and he would slap us severely. This priest would also be particularly cruel on a child if their mother was unmarried or disadvantaged.
When my sister was only 8 years old, a girl in her class was severely beaten by the nun in charge of the class. It was relentless and showed no signs of stopping. My caring, brave sister stood up and said, "Please stop, sister. Don't hurt her anymore. You can hit me instead." I only learned of this story when the same girl, now a woman, recounted it to me at my sister's funeral. That same nun once brought me to the classroom door, put my hand in the jamb, and swung the heavy green door closed on my hand. I can still feel the pain.
The 60s and 70s were my school years. And yes, my school made the scoping list. Everything I'm hearing brings it all back. I moved primary schools as a child. The move meant I ended up going from high babies directly into second class. Nobody cared that I had skipped a year, and I was the class dunce. Every Friday we had exams. On Monday the results were revealed, which for me meant being up at the blackboard, being beaten with the leather strap. Later, in secondary school, one teacher would come to our weekly gym class and personally inspect that no pupil was wearing anything under their gym shorts. Over the years, I have conveniently erased events from my mind only to have the events return when someone asks, "Do you remember?" Is it any wonder the old diaspora in England and further afield have to deal with psychiatric problems, homelessness and other issues?
And listening to that piece there about your hand being brought to the door and a big heavy green door slammed on your hand. So far, this is a list of weapons of mass punishment that have been mentioned, and I'm sure I haven't got them all. I'm trying to jot them down as I go along. By children. Mass punishment inflicted by adults representing the state. Lettered, hurleys, bamboo rods, dado rails, food deprivation, standing on the windowsill, eating flowers, blackthorns, stabbed by a biro, chair legs, wire cabled, hanging on the clothes knob on the back of a door, metal triangle smashed into the blackboard, banister rod, children's cots robbed, locked in a cupboard, boots, fists, feet, walking stick, metal rulers, wire basket, rabbit punches, rabbit kicks, food deprivation, and the list goes on and on. Pori, good afternoon. Your parents spotted that you had been appallingly beaten.
Yes, hello, Joe. Yes, appallingly beaten. This was ongoing. And I suppose the thing is, Joe, that this was not for discipline. None of these beatings
under
any of your listeners. This was for homework. This was for not knowing stuff. You couldn't know it. But yes, beaten on a constant basis, Joe. And my legs were black from the knees up black. My backside was completely black. I couldn't sit down. Well, it was painful to sit down, Joe. But you didn't say anything at home. But one night, I was at the top of the stairs. I was going to bed in the nip, and I happened to be going from one room to the other.
Okay.
And my mother, at that same moment, happened to be at the bottom of the stairs and looked up. And she saw the marks, and she was appalled. And obviously, the question was, what was going on? What happened? So they brought me to the doctor. And I suppose in today's times, the doctor would take action. But, you know, the doctor, it was different times. This was the 60s.
Yeah.
But the doctor said, this isn't right. And he said, you've got to go and make a complaint to the parish priest. I went to the parish priest and was put through the humiliation again, Joe, of, at, you know, at 9, 10 years of age, having to take down your trousers and show all the black marks, which was, for me, I suppose, another humiliation. But the priest's reaction was quite simple. He said, but he's a great teacher. That was the only answer. Yeah. It was the only action. There was no action. He was a great teacher. Now, I don't talk about this much, Joe. I rarely do, because I suppose when it's, you know, when anything comes up about a teacher and you say, God, it was tough, corporal punishment was the order of the day, and people would say, oh, yeah, we all got slapped. And yes, probably everybody that went to school got slapped. You know, I got slapped another time. That doesn't bear with me. This was the constant beatings. And I wasn't the only one. And one of your last speakers said, the teacher picked on certain ones, and there was about in our year there was two or three of us that were picked on. There was some didn't, and that's and the ones that were picked on really, really suffered. You were made to feel useless. You were made to feel you were a dunce. But I suppose the reaction, I suppose, what goes with me now, Joe, when I think back, was how no action was taken by those in authority.
And remember, as I mentioned a few times, it's come up in the programme. Yesterday I mentioned the case of Seamus Keady, Ballyferm, at 7 years of age, 1960s, horrifically beaten in the Mary Queen of Angels School. His parents, it was Patricia and Seamus, from Blackditch Road in Ballyferm, went to the parish priest, who happened to be the Monsignoral Canon Troy, who we all lived in absolute total fear of. He ran Ballyfermot with an iron rod. He decreed that a city, which is Ballyfermot, of 40,000 people, everyone should kneel down in their parlours every evening, and so if you had a parlour in your corporation house, and every family should say the rosary. And as if by diktat, Everyone did it. Such was the power of that man. The family went to the went to the Department of Education, said our child has been savagely beaten. Department of Education wrote back a standard letter, apparently, to Dad. You must go to the school manager. Nothing to do with us. Nothing to do with us. Went to the school manager, the parish priest. The parish priest, just like you, and the priest. The parish priest, Canon Troy, 6'4", I'd say, he brought the child into a room, 7 years of age, interrogated the child, and he decreed that 7-year-old child was lying. The family, what an incredible family. Then the family then went and took a case to the district court. That failed. The judge didn't believe it either. Took the case in the 60s, incredible, to the High Court, and that was thrown out as well. I mentioned the previous case on Tuesday of this week, again of the family who went to court, and the judge threw it out, even though it was self-evident, and said, this is basically a waste of my time. Another case that did go to court, these are so rare, and we know why, but they're so rare that you can find them in newspapers and doll debates brought up by all those great campaigners. There wasn't many of them, but they were great campaigners. The family who went to court won the case, because it was irrefutable, like the other case, but happened to win this case. And the judge asked their solicitor, what compensation do you think would be adequate for what's happened to this child? The solicitor said £1,500. The judge awarded him a shilling. That was his contempt.
Oh my God.
Parik. So thank you for sharing that, Parik, and please look after yourself and look after that 5, 6, 7-year-old child that's still within all of us. Bernadette, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
You tell me you got sick 20 years ago and you're convinced it goes back to what happened in school.
Joe, I mean, I think the thing that I'm most interested in is the impacts that it has. Like, it's so difficult. It really is difficult, and it's difficult to get across the permanence of the damage that was done. Like, it's like they discovered when we were 5 years old. We were fine. We were okay until 5, and then we went into the school, and at 5, they made this discovery that these are the little flawed ones. And they just continued just to beat every day as if that was going to help. But actually, like, what happened was that we learned we were inadequate. And it was like they branded us, you know, on the arm with a stamp. And it seeped into the bloodstream, you know. And it just became a part of you. So you became hypervigilant. And your self-worth was zero. So overcompensating was what you did. And like, it was the fear that remained the whole 9 years, we'll say, of the national system. It was a fear. So fearfulness became your being.
Because it was beaten, literally beaten into
exactly. you. Exactly. Like, cruelty, like, was okay with us. Cruelty was allowed. They were allowed to be cruel with us. And it was almost that it was a necessity and that it would get some sort of other outcome and we might become okay or, you know, adequate like the others if we were beaten. And we believed that ourselves.
Yeah. Of course. You were only children, babies, just beyond infanthood.
That's it. The sorrow and the grief, like, that's in me when, like, you don't talk about it. Like the man there, David, said, you don't talk about it because the depth of grief, you would explode with sorrow and, you know, heartache. Like, and in a way, Joe, listening to the programme over the last few days, that's what I have felt. Mm. I need such a massive cry, but I can't touch into it. And I admire some of the people that's with you. And they cry on the phone and they touch it. But for me, I kept running in case I was found out.
Because of everything you were led to believe about yourself.
Exactly.
by an adult.
Exactly. In my case, like, it was just constant slapping, and my little hands would be blue, you know, the part around your thumb there. Yeah. That was blue every day. And then she hit it again the next day. And you'd get four of those, you know. So your hand was out. And can you imagine the tension that was in your tiny body while you waited for her to land it down and wound you again?
Brenda, we're getting more and more this list of what people were beaten with.
That's
right. And now the beating, and I see one punishment. You were in third class, you fell ill with severe kidney issues.
Yes.
And for your punishment yes. for yeah. being it, you were left to tell us what happened.
Yeah, I'd be left in the hallway, like it was a smallish school, and you were standing on terracotta tiles, because that's all that was throughout the school, except there was wooden floors in the classrooms. But in the corridor, the door was wide open all day. So you were left standing inside that. But you couldn't go to the bathroom, or you couldn't go to play, or you couldn't eat your lunch because you would put crumbs on the floor. So when the other kids went back into the classroom after playtime, you just walked back in again without having had your lunch and without anyone having spoken to you. And, like, do you know the way now as adults, we sometimes hate to be left alone with our thoughts?
Can you imagine for the
teeny weeny person being left alone with why am I such a broken person that I stand alone here in the freezing cold? I can't eat and I can't go outside with the others. And you were expected to be normal, Joe. How could you be?
Yeah.
My granny we had to walk about a half a mile back from that school, and sometimes I'd think to throw away the bread because it would be soggy, or maybe you'd take a bite. But Granny used to notice, and she used to say, why is that child not having her lunch, you know? And she was the one that noticed. And then gradually I just got sicker and sicker. And my GP, I think the doctors, some of them were wonderful, and they understood what's going on. So that was her first question, what's going on at school, you know? But it's so hard, Joe. It's almost impossible for me to tell you how in our bodies it remains.
Yeah. People can hear it in your voice.
Yeah.
The depth of, and hear it in so many voices over the last 10 days, 9 days now. Of the pain and the long lasting. And I'm just thinking again of those lone voices, those campaigning voices who were saying stop corporate punishment. I don't think even then people realised the long term. These were people campaigning, good people campaigning to stop. But I don't think they even would have, I don't think anyone knew that would have such a horrific long term traumatic effect on so many people. Bernard, I'm going to go into the break, but I'm going to ask you to listen to just a couple of voice messages we're getting about the weapons of mass punishment that were used on children in Irish schools.
Thank you, Joe.
Okay, I'll take the break and then I'll go back to Seamus and Terence.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
I was reared in a small village in County Mayo. My early primary school years were fine, but later, when I moved up to the senior years, all that changed. I have a litany of horror stories. I'll share a few. My teacher hammered me with the side of her ruler while keeping my hand held so I couldn't move. All this because a little small blob of ink dropped from my fountain pen when taking it out of the inkwell. The soft part of my thumb was cut so badly, blood poured from it. I still have a scar, a reminder of that beating today. Another morning I was hammered across the head and face with her hands as she stood behind me, and it continued until I vomited. The same day, the school photographer came and we were called individually for our photograph. When my term came, my teacher said, "Go, but I'll finish with you after." She was true to her word. Needless to say, the photos show the sadness in my eyes as I knew what was ahead of me again.
In 1966, I was 8 years old and taught by the De La Salle brothers. At the end of the day, a brother wanted to keep me back for football practice to play against an older team. I couldn't stay back and said so. My next memory is coming to in the schoolyard. I'd been knocked out and left there by him.
Dear Joe, what can I say? It's my birthday this week. I'm in my late 60s. It's also my wedding anniversary, over 40 years together. But listening to your show, I'm heartbroken. In relation to my school days, I remember nothing but the bad ones. My stomach tightens as I say this. I lived in fear. I got up in the morning, I went to school in fear, I came home in fear, went to bed in fear. My mother told me I was a dunce. When I got home, I was asked, "Well, did you wear the dunce's hat today?" The shame is felt to this day. If you don't have a good start in life, it goes on forever. I'm actually not too bad. I can read and write, but figures continue to be my downfall.
Seamus, you describe it as a whip that was used.
That's right, Joe, yeah. My memory of it now has gone back, at, what, 45 years now?
Yeah.
A white horsehair whip. That's my abiding memory of it. And that was an upgrade. The principal, it was De La Salle School, and it was a leather belt, about a foot long maybe, but we came back after one summer and it had been upgraded to a horsehair whip.
An actual whip, a whip used in...
That's my memory of it. It's a long time. That's my memory of it. An actual whip. Now, I have to say, I didn't see it being used. I was okay academically, so I wasn't at the receiving end. But, you know, a jockey doesn't have a whip for show. You know, it's used.
I'm told shoes were used to beat children.
That's another brother... And again, he came into the class and he could sit in the class for 45 minutes, wherever the class was, and stare at the wall. And nobody would move a muscle. And that could be for 45 minutes. And he could just take off his shoe and whack it at someone. Mm. Or the wooden dusters, like other people have spoken about them.
Yeah.
That would be normal. I mean, they're weapons. They're dangerous weapons.
Yeah.
And these are the old heavy leather shoes. From a big man.
What contempt. Not just the physical abuse visited on so many children by so many adults, but contempt to come into a class and sit there and stare at the wall and ignore the children.
I'm not even sure it was deliberate. I think the man had serious mental issues. It could have been got the impression of that kind of a mental breakdown scenario. But... He was just left there. Like, the education was secondary, obviously. And, you know, in all of the stories that people have told, the fear that's there, you cannot learn when you're afraid. You know, it's just torture.
Yeah.
Just endless torture. It's some of those stories are...
Okay. Thanks indeed, Seamus. The fear. Terence.
How are you, Joe?
How are you?
Good, how are you?
You want to share? Go ahead, Terence.
Yeah, Joe, I was listening back to your show yesterday and I think you finished on the list of weapons that that the teachers and the brothers used on the pupils over the years. And one that came to mind to me was a length of rubber tubing that... two teachers were in the process of siphoning petrol from one of their cars. This would have been around 1978-79, primary school in Dublin. We were out playing in the yard. Teachers' cars were parked in the yard. There was a big GAA field at the front in the school in the yard where we played football or, you know, made sure we kept away from the teachers' cars.
Yeah.
And there was two lay teachers. And in my experience... the lay teachers were the ones that were the abusers. The Christian brothers were actually, in my experience and what I saw, I know you had Christian brother education, both primary and secondary.
Yeah.
The Christian brothers were all right. The lay teachers were, some of them were evil. It was a sport to some of them. Abusing the kids was a perk of the job from what I could see. But there was two of them anyway, and they were siphoning petrol out of one of the cars. Obviously, one teacher needed a
run out of petrol, yeah.
And one of the lads got a little bit too nosy for his own good, and the teacher, they were in the process, so the hose was still in the tank, and they were the petrol was flowing into the container, and they beckoned the young fellow over with the finger, come on over here for a minute.
Yeah.
And they took the length of rubber hose out of the tank, and they gave him, they leathered both hands, and told the young fellow to go on his way, and carried on then siphoning the petrol out of the car.
Another weapon to add. There was no end to their ingenuity.
Oh, it didn't give as much as a thought. You know, it was just hold on for a sec now, and we just let her, this young fleas, getting too nosy for his own good.
It's a child. And remember,
I'm talking about 8-9 year old child.
Yesterday,
you know?
Where does the depths? How? Depths of depravity that would make a teacher look at a wire waste paper basket and see in that basket a way of horribly punishing a child, not by lifting up the basket to hit the child, God forbid, or to throw at it at the child, not to upturn the basket so the child would be made sit on the basket in front of the class, maybe with, as we heard, a dunce's hat on them. No, the ingenuity was, get in, sit in that basket, put your little behind into that basket, and gradually you would sink into the basket. And the metal rods, the metal prongs at the top of that steel basket will slowly eat into your back and eat into the calves of your little knees, with your ankle socks and your little Duke shoes, if you're lucky enough, wearing them. And it would go down and down and down. Scabs would form eventually on the backs of your knees and God knows wherever else. And this teacher, when he saw that the scabs had formed and were healing, would take it upon himself to find a reason to put that same child into sinking into that metal basket. Where in the name of good God does that depravity come from? joe@rte.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And like so many people, Teresa's husband has been sparked, and memories have been sparked by the conversation over the last week. But Teresa, it was bizarrely a parquet floor which reignited memories, bad memories for your husband.
Yes, Joe. My husband is 70 years of age now, and he was abused, like, in school. That he left school at 14. He was battered across the legs and in the hands. And I asked him today, telling him I was coming online or talking to you, why was he hit like that and whatever? And he said it's because... it was just power on them. It was just evil. They were evil people. But anyway, what brought to me, and I'd like to people that to talk to people that is living with somebody that was abused as a child.
Yeah, yeah.
I went out to buy a herringbone flower about 2 years ago, and I brought my husband with him for colour and whatever. He wouldn't have known what a herringbone flower was until he went and seen it. So when we were in the shop, I was showing him it, and he said, oh, that's like school. And his face just went white. And you know yourself, when, you know, I knew then at that minute I couldn't buy a herringbone flower. I couldn't bring a herringbone flower into my home where my husband would be sitting and looking at that flower and then starting to live that nightmare that he went through in his school life. So, you know, there are little things like that that people don't say, the after effect that somebody could bring into a home. And, you know, bring all this up and, you know, so...
And I was looking through other emails. There's one email where this adult still feels they have the mark. They were so savagely pushed into the herringbone floor, the parquet floor or whatever, that they feel they still have the mark and the pattern of the parquet floor on their cheek. Such was the horror. But it's great that you're with your husband when these... people are sharing, like yourself, yeah. Teresa. So it's deeply appreciated. Yeah. More, and, yeah, go ahead, yeah. Teresa.
And thank you for bringing this up, because no, I think it well needs to be said.
Yeah.
And like when I was talking to my husband this morning, like he would have thinking, you know, this happened everywhere, and happened, you yeah. know, it didn't yeah. only happen to him. It was a normal thing, and it wasn't talked about. It was just cruelty,
yeah.
you know, and it was accepted.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, so it's about time them people are getting some recognition, you know, that yeah. it was wrong and it's not their fault.
Here, here.
Do you know what I mean? So yeah. well done to you for bringing it to the limelight.
But no one could have predicted when this conversation began at 1:45 last Tuesday week, just after the Scope report was published, I could not have predicted that the horrors that we've heard so often about sexual abuse would suddenly go back into physical abuse. And as I say, the what's been opened has been shocking about physical abuse. Thank you, Teresa, and kind regards to your husband. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. Maura, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you? Thanks for taking my call. So myself and my friends, this is really touching a lot of us, and my friends. Older sister had the same experience at the hands of a nun. So very briefly, my dad worked in CIE, and we could go travel freely. So every year we used to go over to Brighton to my mother's sister on holidays. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So we would get the free ferry over, and my dad would always ask for permission from the head nun. I have to be very careful now, from the school, to get permission that I'd miss that half day. Okay.
Okay.
So fast track then, I'm going in on the Monday. So the half day was before you'd say you'd start in September. So on Monday, I rocked into this nun's class. And prior to that, I had really lovely lay teachers and a very positive experience. I was the youngest of four and happy-go-lucky, no idea, you know, very, very lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, I go into this lady and she brings me up to the top of the class. Now, I had a bit of a turn in my foot, and I used to go to Irish dancing, but I couldn't do it. And my the GP recommended to my mother that I go to ballet for posture, okay?
Okay.
Because I couldn't manage the slapping of the Irish dancing. So before she ever met me, she brought me to the top of the class and she said, and here is Maura X. And she's posher than everybody else. She was in London, if you don't, or England, if you don't mind, okay. on a holiday. Mm. And she's going to the Presbyterian school up the road, the Protestant school, to learn ballet. Right now, anyway. So based on that then, okay, so that was her first impression of me. I didn't know what to make of her. On the same day then, and I forget the poor lady's name, but all the teachers, all the business people's kids were up in the front row and I was designated to the back, okay?
Yeah.
And when we had to hold up our copybooks, my mum, I used to cover them with either wallpaper or brown paper, invariably wallpaper. We couldn't afford contact. It was never even considered. So she made a big joke out of all of this as well. A few of us had brown paper and made us stand at the top of the class. But anyway, as the weeks proceeded anyway, I started to develop a stammer, and we used to have to brasso our inkwells, and she was horrible. We used to wear footers. They were your father's socks on your shoes so that you wouldn't mark the tile floor. You'd nearly brain yourself going up and down the stairs. But anyway, it culminated anyway in one day she used to hit me every morning. For no reason, so I just used to get into the habit of standing. And it was that, it wasn't a bamboo, it was a long teak-like with a good broad parameter on it now, maybe 4 or 5 inches, and she would hit it, turn it on the side so that she'd get you. And like the other gentleman yesterday, sometimes she would make you turn your hands over so she'd get you on the knuckles.
Ah. And the list goes on. She used to make you stand on the windowsill. We've heard that before. And open and close.
Oh, yeah, did you hear this?
Open and close the window. Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, I used to climb up. So in the school that I attended, it was on the third floor. And I was small for my age. We used to stand up there and open the windows. And you'd have to clean the windows. But one day I jumped down and didn't I land on the Virgin Mary. Broke the statue. And she nearly lost her reason. I was petrified of her. I started wetting the bed.
Oh,
I developed a stammer.
Oh,
I went from being happy-go-lucky on a Sunday from 4 o'clock onwards to becoming really anxious. And I think that was the source of anxiety for me.
Okay.
But the awful thing that she did to me was this. The worst thing than anything was, apart from physical cruelty, as punishment, you can sit down beside X and X, who were separated from everybody in vertical rows. There was a blank row of desks, and in the corner were travellers.
And that was regarded as punishment.
And she said, okay. And as punishment, you can go down and sit with X and X. As it happened, I went down, and I had never aware of that disparity.
Okay.
That hadn't been the case in the previous, in senior infants, first or second. We were all mixed together. I got on great with the girls, and, you know, they helped me cope because we were just totally alienated. But in the Easter,
I'm way over time. Apologies.
That's
and apologies.
No problem, Joe. No, look,
you're very good.
So
kind of you and so understanding. I agree. It's so important. Back tomorrow. Apologies. Sound James Feeney, broadcast coordinator Shane Galvin, producer Owen McLaughlin. Ray Darcy is next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Their new autumn range will leave you bursting with ideas. View in-store or at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.